Massive new developments tonight in the murder of DNC staffer Seth Rich, who was murdered last summer. A federal investigator telling Fox News that an FBI forensic report of Rich's computer showed he made contact with WikiLeaks through a former reporter and London-based WikiLeaks director, Gavin McFadden. The investigator told Fox News Rich provided McFadden with more than 44,000 emails, nearly 18,000 attachments. Rich was murdered near his D.C. home on the morning of July 10th, but his wallet, his cell phone, his watch not taken. WikiLeaks, 12 days later, published internal emails showing top DNC officials trading ideas on how to hurt Senator Bernie Sanders at the polls, and those emails resulting in the resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is the chair of the DNC and the DNC's three top officials, because of the obvious conclusion portrayed in those emails between the DNC and the Clinton campaign. Rich's contact with WikiLeaks, corroborated by private investigator and former D.C. detective Rod Wheeler, who was hired by a third party to investigate this case. A Rich family spokesman claiming the report is unsubstantiating and added, quote, "Even if tomorrow an email was found, it is not a high enough bar of evidence to prove any interactions, as emails can be altered, and we've seen that those interested in pushing conspiracies will stop at nothing to do so." Those are the words of the family spokesperson, who is also a Democratic crisis management and public relations expert.
Well, you got a quick refresher on the murder DNC staffer Seth Rich's case, courtesy of Fox News. Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson. My guest today is lawyer Eden Quainton, who is representing former Fox News analyst and financial manager Ed Batowski in a defamation suit brought against Ed by Seth Rich's brother, Aaron Rich. Aaron's lawsuit claims that Batowski falsely and repeatedly alleged that Aaron is a criminal who helped his brother steal the DNC documents and give them to WikiLeaks in exchange for payment, and that Aaron obstructed justice to cover his tracks after Seth's murder. Well, Batowski has brought a steely Renaissance man to represent him in this fight. Quainton is an Ivy Leaguer. He was reared overseas, and he speaks five languages. After graduating summa cum laude from Yale and getting his law degree with distinction, he graduated summa cum laude from Yale and then got his law degree with distinction from Stanford University. And then he went to work for top corporate firms like Kravitz, Swain & Moore, Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen, and Hamilton, and Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meagher, and Flom. He became a partner at Skadden, Arps. His clients back then were corporations and investment banks like Air France, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and HSBC, who, Quainton says, demanded that their attorneys walk through walls to win a case or close a deal. Then he did an about-face. Mr. Quainton now aims to walk through walls and win cases for small businesses, nonprofit organizations, and individuals like Ed Batowski. Nice to have you with us, Mr. Quainton.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, you have just submitted an extraordinary legal document to the judge in the Aaron Rich versus Batowski case. It's titled Outstanding Discovery, and it's quite the redacted redacted filing. That being said, if you follow the leads in it, an extraordinary picture comes into focus. Could you talk about that document, what it is, and tell us about it to the extent that you can?
Sure. Let me just say, by way of starting on this, that this is a difficult case to talk about, and I hope that your listeners won't be disappointed. The reason that it's difficult to talk about is that There's a protective order in place, and that protective order allows parties to designate materials as what's called attorney's eyes only, and then to designate other materials as confidential.
Right.
And the materials that are attorney's eyes only, as the name indicates, can only be shared with attorneys. They can't even be shared with parties. So there are some things that I have seen that my own clients have not seen.
Wow.
And so that is an issue that I hope to address, and I'm in discussions with the other side as to removing some of those restrictions. But as of today, there's still a lot of material that is subject to AEO. So let me backtrack on the document to answer your question. I came onto this case in November of 2019, and so it had been going on for quite some time. And I think Mr. Batowski had two lawyers previously, but he was unrepresented at the time that I came on. And the discovery was set to expire at the end of January, so there was very little time to complete discovery. And Mr. Batowski has been extremely suffering. He had a surgery that was botched, and he's had infections. He's been in and out of the hospital, and particularly over the end of last year, early part of this year, the suffering and the pain that he's been in has been extraordinary. So his ability to participate in the litigation has been very limited.
Right.
So at the end of January, I filed a motion, and I believe you'll see this on the docket, asking for an extension of time, and I asked for 90 days or even a stay of discovery altogether. The judge extended discovery 60 days, which was to the end of March, but Mr. Batowski remained in the hospital. In fact, he just got out of the hospital again, where he's been for 12 days, this has been one of the biggest challenges of my career because, much as we lawyers like to think that what we do is important, I mean, nothing is as important as a person's health. And so sometimes I have a question about discovery or a document, and to be perfectly honest with you, I feel just awful sometimes calling up my client when he's in the hospital or just getting out of the hospital. So that's been difficult. In any event, the judge said at a last conference we had in March, he said, okay, the deadline of March 27th, I'm going to stick with that. I'm going to stay the entire case for 45 days because of the coronavirus crisis.
Right.
But I want a complete list from you, both sides, of everything that's outstanding. And kind of this is your, this is your last chance to ask me for things that you want. And also to give me an update on where things are. So what I did in the document that you're referring to was to describe for the judge all of the requests that we had made, the responses that we had been given, and then the various documents that we felt we still needed to establish our defense and the parties that we wanted to depose for our defense. And as you see from the judge's ruling, we got we got a fair bit of what we wanted, but certainly not everything. And there are some outstanding questions that I'm going to be going back to the judge and asking for clarification on. There were some subpoenas that I had already issued, but that hadn't been served, and the judge's order says those documents can't be served. But I think that may be a misunderstanding from my letter. So I have a couple of issues, and this deals with the FBI in particular, and CrowdStrike, and the Freedom of Press Foundation, where I had subpoenas that were validly issued but hadn't yet been served, and I want to clarify that because they were validly issued, they've actually been responded to, although with objections. I want to make clear that I can pursue that. I think particularly with the FBI.
Well, what I did with your document was, your document is a series of breadcrumbs to publicly available information, but it puts it all together. If you follow the breadcrumbs in your outstanding discovery, this picture comes into focus that is quite extraordinary. And one thing I noticed, and I don't know if, I'm sure it struck you too, that in his, because I read the defamation submission, I find it interesting that he does not talk about, he doesn't begin with the initiating event that got Batowski into this thing in the first place. He starts with Batowski hiring Rod Wheeler. In other words, he completely, it's almost, you tell me, kind of a sin of omission that he doesn't talk about Batowski gets this call from Ratner, asks Ratner, that whole, you know, asks Ratner to please, Ratner asks him to please call the Rich family and tell them that, you know, Assange, Ratner, who had just, who had met with Assange, that Ratner doesn't want to call them, but wants Ed to call on her behalf to tell him that Assange is worried that maybe his Seth's murder was connected to the WikiLeaks exchange, you know, to Seth giving the stuff to WikiLeaks, and that Assange wanted them to know that indeed, you know, he got him from Seth and possibly Aaron, I don't know. But anyway, that whole initiating event is not in the defamation, is not even mentioned as true, false, it's not even mentioned. Did you notice that?
Well, I think you're right that one of the problems with this whole story is what you call the sins of omission. And I would agree with that. And one of the things that I find remarkable when I look at the kind of the mainstream press coverage, and you know, there's been coverage recently, and there may be additional coverage, you know, in the days ahead or weeks ahead. As you know, the Fox News story that you led with was published on, if my memory is correct, on May 16th of 2017. So yes, it's kind of an anniversary marker, if you will, and. What I find remarkable in the various you know, mainstream press recountings of this whole saga is what they leave out. And I think if your listeners were to take one thing away from this call that the mainstream press leaves out, and I'm talking about, you know, Michael Isikoff, and I'm talking about HBO that did the what they call the After Truth special, what they leave out is the Cy Hirsch audio. Which is an audio that was recorded by Mr. Batowski that has Cy Hirsch. And for your listeners who don't know, and I'm sure you know, obviously you know, Cy Hirsch is one of the giants of investigative reporting in the 20th century. It's, you know, he's a leftist. He exposed the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War. I mean, truly a towering figure, and I've always admired him. When you listen to the audio, there is simply, in my opinion, no way to conclude that audio is fabricated, that he's just lying. And what he says is that somebody read to him an FBI report on which there.
Why don't we play that clip?
Sure.
Why
go ahead.
Don't we play that clip?
Yeah, I think that's a very good idea.
We have a. That's the third bite. We're going to play a clip from that so that, you know, people can hear what you're talking about.
Sure.
Anyway, they found what he had done. He had submitted a series of documents, of emails, some juicy emails from the DNC. And, you know, by the way, all this shit about the DNC, you know, whether hacked or wasn't hacked, but whatever happened, the Democrats themselves wrote this shit. You know what I mean? All I know is that he offered a sample, an extensive sample, you know, I'm sure dozens of emails, and said, I want money. That later, WikiLeaks did get the password. He had a Dropbox, a protected Dropbox, which isn't hard to do. I mean, you don't have to be a wizard, IT wizard. You know, he was certainly, you know, he's not a dumb kid. They got access to the Dropbox. He also, and this is also in the FBI report, he also let people know with whom he was dealing. And I don't know how he dealt. I'll tell you about WikiLeaks in a second. I don't know how he dealt with the WikiLeaks and the mechanism, but he also, the word was passed, according to the FBI report, I also shared this box with a couple of friends. So if anything happens to me, it's not going to solve your problem.
So, take it away, Mr. Quainton. Do you have something to add to that? I mean, I find it interesting that that they never talk about. And I asked, by the way, I interviewed Cy about his book, and at the very end, I asked him about this, and he goes, "Well, there were mitigating circumstances," and he tried to backpedal away from what he had said here.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess the first point, and your interview sounds like it corroborates that, is that, you know, that is Cy Hirsch's voice. I mean, I don't personally know Cy Hirsch. I don't personally know his voice, but people who do, I mean, and I'm not talking about my client, but others who know him,
no,
tell me that is his voice.
He admitted it. He admitted it to me. It's definitely him.
So it's definitely Cy Hirsch's voice, and you played a very short extract. I think the video the audio that people can get on the internet, there are various ways you can just Google it, but I think there's a version that's about 20 or 24 minutes long, and the level of detail that Cy Hirsch gets into is just completely inconsistent with a fabrication. There's nothing in the sound of his voice. There's nothing in the details. This is all extemporaneous. He doesn't. By the way, he doesn't know he's being recorded. This is one of the reasons I understand he was, he was upset. But that is his voice. Those are details that one cannot, I don't think, just have made up. So I'm baffled, frankly, why the mainstream press doesn't, press a little bit more on that. I'm hoping to have a deposition with Cy Hirsch, so I don't want to say much more about this than that. I'm interested in learning as much as I can. But I think that Cy had a story that he might have been working on, and felt that the audio coming out caused. I don't know what he told you. I haven't listened to your interview. Whether he felt that then he could no longer pursue the story, and he didn't appreciate that having happened, but leaving that aside, I mean, I just defy anybody with a fair mind to listen to that whole audio and say, he was just making that up. Doesn't make any sense to me.
Well,
that he would have backpedaled. That does make sense to me because, he wanted. He wanted to be the master of the way he was telling his story, and it got ahead of him, and I guess he was upset about that.
Well, maybe he was also, yeah, exactly. So now we have Batowski, who in the defamation suit, they don't talk about the initiating event. They only talk about him bringing on Rod Wheeler. Mm-hmm. So let's play Rod Wheeler's fight. So what did Rod Wheeler say?
Before you get to Rod Wheeler, I think it's probably important if your listeners really want to trace through kind of what's out there, which I think is a very good thing for anybody who's really interested in this story, I think to educate yourself on what is publicly available and see how it's addressed in the media is, that's really the way to go. That's what I would encourage everybody to do. You mentioned Ellen Ratner, and I'm not going to get into the interactions between Ms. Ratner and my client, but there's an audio available on the internet in which
play that audio. Could you just play the Ratner audio, which is the fourth bite?
I spent 3 hours with Julian Assange on Saturday at the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
Get this. Listen to this. Go ahead.
Well, I did.
Yeah.
But one of the things he did say is that the leaks were not from the Russians. They were an internal source from the Hillary campaign or from somebody that knew Hillary, an enemy. He does not think they're from Russians, and he said Russia got credit for something WikiLeaks should have gotten credit for.
I mean, nobody pays attention to that either.
No, they absolutely don't, and I find that to be, Christine, I find that to be extraordinary. I mean, that is highly relevant, and I don't know if we'll get into this. We probably should. The whole the Mueller report and the way that the Mueller report deals with Julian Assange and the allegations around Seth Rich. I mean, it appears to me, and I don't have any inside information, just a fair warning, but it appears to me, from everything that I know, that the special counsel's team never interviewed Julian Assange, that they never examined his computers, they never examined any of his documents, as far as I know. Now, there could be some stuff out there, but I believe they just ran with a one-sided narrative, and you have a statement here by somebody who's highly credible. Again, Ellen Ratner is a leftist. You know, she's not, not that there's anything wrong with people on the right or being conservative, but it is not a conservative, you know, kind of narrative. She's a leftist family, prominent leftist family, and she is saying that Julian Assange told her that it was a DNC insider, not much more than that. But you would have thought that any fair investigation would have at least dealt with that. And there's absolutely nothing in the Mueller report. There's just a kind of a one paragraph statement in the entire Mueller report. It was 400 and some pages, and he has seven lines, and he says that that WikiLeaks' insinuations about Seth Rich are false. That's it. Nothing more at all. And that's truly a remarkable omission that I cannot explain in any that I just simply can't explain.
Well, I think that there are other people too that they don't talk about, and one of them is Craig Murray, the former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, acquaintance of Julian Assange's, who claims to have directly communicated with the WikiLeaks source for the DNC emails. Did anybody try and talk to Craig?
Well, absolutely. I'm trying to talk to Craig. I mean, in my my document, the document called Outstanding Discovery. And by the way, just in case your listeners are confused, you weren't flattering me by saying it's an outstanding discovery document. The title is Outstanding Discovery. It's the title is simply discovery that remains outstanding. That's left to be done. It's not not
a
being flattered.
Fabulous discovery.
Right, fabulous discovery. Great job, Mr. Clayton. That's not what it means. It just means discovery left to be done. And one of the depositions that I said I'd like some help with is a deposition of Craig Murray. The judge rightly said that in-person depositions with the coronavirus were not going to be possible, and I suggested that I'd be willing to do what's called a Rule 31 deposition, which is by written questions. And that,
why can't
that was,
we do video depositions? What's wrong with that?
We could do video
anyway, like Zoom.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think Craig Murray would be a great person to interview. The judge shot that down. Now, if I can work out something amicably, so if anybody out there knows, by the way, who's listening, happens to know how I might get in touch with Mr. Murray, I would love any leads, because he's in. I understand he was following the Julian Assange trial, and I haven't followed it very closely, but I think he made some comments in his blog that have been characterized as, I'm not sure what they were characterized as, but he's got himself in some legal trouble simply for commenting on the Julian Assange extradition hearings. Have you been following that?
I'm not aware of what he said. I know that he has been following them. I think he's been attending, actually. By the way, what about Kim.com, who also said he had direct communication with Seth Rich relating to the transmission of the DNC emails to WikiLeaks. What about him? Nobody talks about him either in the mainstream press.
Yeah, nobody talks about Kim.com, and that is another remarkable omission. And I don't know if you have the clip teed up with Kim.com, but I think I mentioned this in my document. There's an interview with Kim.com, and he's on an outlet called Consortium News. And if my memory is correct, somewhere around the 42nd minute of that interview, Kim.com explains that he had been in touch with Seth Rich, and Seth Rich had information, and Kim.com, this is his testimony, put Seth in touch with an intermediary who could help him get the materials to WikiLeaks. Kim.com also says something that I think is highly significant, which is that unlike what Cy Hirsch says in his clip, and I think actually Kim.com would know more about this because he's a real internet whiz, is my understanding, is that the process of submitting documents to WikiLeaks is actually quite complicated, is my understanding. I'll get into that in a second. But what he says is he thinks Seth would have had to have worked with somebody very close to him who he really trusted. And with something like this, there wouldn't be very many people like that around. So that's highly significant. Now, why is it so difficult to communicate with WikiLeaks? My understanding is the way that it works is you have to do it not through, quote-unquote, Dropbox. I think that's a misnomer. But I'm
it's
not, you know,
secure
I'm not sure.
Drop. Yeah, he didn't.
Secure
well,
drop.
You know,
yeah.
Cy doesn't.
Yeah, he doesn't. You know, I don't think he's
do that stuff.
He doesn't give stuff to WikiLeaks. So I, you know, as far as I know, so he hasn't dealt with that. But I think you have to download a Tor browser, and you know how to use a Tor browser, and then you know upload the stuff through the browser, and you know manipulate the secure drop. It's highly encrypted, and it's designed to protect whistleblowers. So it's very, very hard to get information about that process. That's one of my outstanding subpoenas, by the way, is to the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which is the parent company that runs the secure drop. And I'm my thought is, well, maybe they've got some information that might be helpful. But you know, I think that Kim.com statement, he's made other statements in the past. Are something that the mainstream press should really deal with this. And if they're going to be fair, they should address that.
They haven't spoken either much about Assange offering a $20,000 reward for anyone with information leading to the arrest and conviction of Seth's murderer. So my question to you is, have you reached out to WikiLeaks? I mean, what they the silencio from that end is, it's very loud, I'd say. What is it about reaching out to WikiLeaks? What's the deal with that?
Well, it is, as you know, Julian Assange is in prison right now, and it's very difficult to get through to him. One of the other, Mr. Butowski's other lawyers, Ty Clevenger, he's been working this case and these issues for Mr. Butowski for longer than I have, and I think he's been trying very hard. What I can tell you is, and this is really extraordinary in my opinion, when I came on the case, this is again in November, we're getting towards the end of discovery, and one of the documents that plaintiff put in was a request for assistance from the judge for taking Julian Assange's deposition. And they stressed how important that deposition would be from their perspective.
Wow.
Which is truly remarkable. And then, you know, I jumped on and said, absolutely, 100%. And I agree. This is a critical and it's a necessary and it's relevant, which is what both sides agreed. And we asked the judge if we could have his assistance. So there's a procedure called a letters rogatory, which is a letter that issues to another court to get assistance in, you know, obtaining some kind of a judicial relief. And there are other less formal mechanisms as well that can be used. But the judge denied that. And,
why?
I don't know. I do not know. I think that's, frankly, I think that's a problem for plaintiff in this case. Because
he's saying, to me, though,
I need to talk to Julian Assange to prove my case, and he can't talk to Julian Assange. I mean, I find that, you know, I don't know how he's going to walk that back, where he, but that's a remarkable thing. The way nobody wants to talk to
what they think Assange would say that would exonerate Seth and Aaron? I mean...
Yeah, I think that's what they're thinking. I think what they were thinking is that Julian has been very protective of sources and appears to be protective of sources to the extent of even risking his own life. I mean, whatever you think of Julian Assange, I mean, he's a person who's taken extraordinary risks for what he believes in. And I think that they were hoping that if the judge did grant them the relief that they wanted, that Assange would refuse to say anything about the sources. That's my suspicion. And they were really confident. I don't know if you have the well-known clip from from August in 2016 where Assange.
I don't have a full archive of clips. But go ahead, talk about it, because I know what you're going to talk about, and I think it's important.
It is important. This is an interview that this is actually one I think Seth Rich came on the radar screen for a lot of people. I can't recall if this is when Seth Rich came on the radar screen for me. I think it was when round about this time. So this is August of 2016, a month after Seth's murder, and the sort of the Russian conspiracy stuff is starting to really pick up steam, and Assange intimates to a Dutch reporter that his sources take extraordinary risks. And the reporter says, well, no, Seth Rich, that was just a botched robbery, right? And Assange says that, well, that hasn't been proved. And he offers this $20,000 reward for information leading to solving the information about the murder of Seth Rich. And, his pushing back on this Dutch reporter's statement that it was a botched robbery and his offering of the reward and his statement that his sources take, great risks, these fueled speculation that this was sort of, kind of a wink to people out there that Seth was the leaker. But there's nothing really more than that. And I don't believe he's made any other public statements about Seth Rich.
Just the fact that he would say that would give me pause if I were in Aaron's shoes. That would give me pause to want to depose him. I mean, because he really seems to want Seth's murderer to be brought to justice.
Mm-hmm. He certainly does. And again, I can only speculate as to why Aaron and his team were so eager to have Assange's deposition. Maybe they knew that the judge would deny it, and they could present themselves as being sort of the good guys. But again, if they say this is critical and necessary, and then they don't get the information, that's a big hole in their case. Now, I think they're going to try to hang their hat on the Mueller report. This is the gospel, and the Mueller report, the first volume one, is all about the sort of the Russian collusion conspiracy stuff, and the piece of the Mueller report, the first half of the Mueller report, that deals with the Russian hacking, is largely a regurgitation of the indictment that Mueller issued against the 12 Russian military intelligence people that the indictment claims were responsible for hacking the DNC.
And that's in tatters, though. The whole Mueller report is in tatters. These allegations are in tatters. I mean, what are they going to do if that's what they're using? I mean, that's less than a fig leaf at this point, isn't it?
Well, I wish I could say that were the case. I mean, I think that we will see some you know, people trying to shore up the credibility of the Mueller report. You still hear people who, you know, who sort of, in my opinion, should know better, who talk about the Mueller report in the volume one as though it were gospel. And I think one point that I would make as a lawyer for listeners to think about is the indictment of those Russian military intelligence officers is an indictment. It's not proof. It's not a fact. It's a theory that was established by the government. And tellingly, the Mueller team had a second indictment that I'm sure you know about, which is the indictment of the Russian troll farm. You know, Internet Research Agency. And when one of the defendants, I think it's called Concord Management, decided to show up in court and fight that case, eventually Mueller has been forced to drop the case. So, because he couldn't prove it. And I think that tells you that these indictments should not be taken as gospel truth. They're just an indictment. And as a matter of law, every defendant, whatever defendant, you know, Russian, French, American, you know, Taiwanese, whatever, is entitled to a presumption of innocence. So you simply can't say this proves a case.
New development that was quite striking, and that was, I hope you'll refresh my memory on this, that CrowdStrike's PR person came forward and said that the CrowdStrike report did not definitively show that the Russians were the ones who did this.
I'm not aware of that, actually. Just for your listeners, CrowdStrike is the firm that was hired to examine the DNC servers, and it's there. So it's a private company that was hired by the DNC, and it's their evidence, not the government's evidence, but it's their evidence that forms the basis for this indictment. So it's an unproven series of allegations based on forensic analysis done by a private company affiliated with the entity that would have a reason to be promoting something that's not true.
I'm gonna look for that and send it to you, because I know I'm not dreaming about this. Their PR guy came forward, because you know they never submitted a complete report. What they did submit was redacted, and their PR guy, the last few months. PR guy from CrowdStrike came forward and said, no, we didn't definitively say that the Russians did this. So that's, you know, that's kind of a big deal. One of the things I want to do now is, because the other part of this whole saga is the control that the DNC lawyers and operatives and so on, their activities with respect to trying to keep this whole Seth Rich narrative under control. I think one of the most the first thing I want to do is I do want to play that bite, Rod Wheeler bite, because he sort of starts the ball rolling on that. Jess, could you play that bite for me, please?
Federal investigator, we're in an unusual situation. An FBI forensic report showing 44,000 emails, 18,000 attachments. That approximates just about what was released by WikiLeaks through the campaign and leading up to the election itself last summer. Do you think that's a coincidence?
Well, no, I actually don't think it's a coincidence, but I do want to emphasize, first off here, Lou, that I have never seen the emails themselves. The information that I have gotten is information that has come through Fox News from that federal investigator, and then what I've done is taken that information to try to corroborate it. Mm-hmm. Because what we want to do whenever we have a source, as you well know, we always like to check on the credibility of that information coming in.
What have you found in that regard?
Well, what I have found is that his information that he shared with Fox News is pretty consistent with everything else that I've been learning, including the fact that right now no one seems to know where the computers are that belong to Seth Rich. The computers obviously were confiscated at some point. The police department tells me they don't know where they are. The FBI says they're not involved. So my question is, well, who has the computers?
Yeah, who has a computer and why? First, as the primary investigative department, why doesn't the D.C. Metropolitan Police know where evidence is? And if there was a forensic, and there has been, a forensic report created by the FBI, why don't the investigating detectives know where it is, what's in those emails, how many there are? We have a very precise number from that federal investigator, but none of this explains why the FBI is involved and why there are claims that the D.C. detectives were told to stand down.
Right, and that's a claim that I actually heard myself from a detective who said, Rod, we were told not to investigate this fully. Now, see, that's interesting because that's consistent with what this federal investigator said. The federal investigator never knew, Lou, that I had heard from a detective in the police department to stand down. Well, if this guy says the same thing, you have to start saying to yourself, well, maybe there's some truth behind this. So that's why I think when you look at the totality of everything that we have right now, it's very consistent with what this federal investigator has said. Now, I don't think that the police department has intentionally covered up anything pertaining to this case. I think it comes from someone above the police department. That's just my sense, Lou.
And we should point out the mayor herself denying that she issued any kind of stand-down order, as described, obviously, by some of those within the department. But again, we don't have an explanation why Washington, D.C. seems to be where investigations go to die, whether they originate with the federal government or the D.C. Metropolitan Police. This is a strange, strange, again, unresolved investigation with obvious frustration on the part of the local detectives who are who have this case in their hands, as well as the federal authorities, again, without explanation about why federal authorities are involved here.
So, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of that, you know, it speaks for itself. The issues that are raised there get into some of the AEO, what I call the AEO, Attorney's Eyes Only material. And so I really can't comment very much on that. You know, I think that Mr. Wheeler's comments there are very telling. And, you know, there are other comments as well. I mean, I think Wheeler did an interview with an outlet called Crowdsource the Truth with Jason Goodman, and I think it was in June of 2017, and he dropped some breadcrumbs there that I think are very interesting. He doesn't say very much, but what he does say I think is interesting.
What do you say?
Well, I want to be careful about that. He gets into a little. I don't have it in front of me. I don't know if you have the clip by any chance. But I'd rather have you tee that up. One of the things that you've got to, you know, Mr. Wheeler filed a lawsuit in August of 2017 against Ed Batowski and Fox News, and I think he claimed that he was misquoted, and you know, I think he alleges some wild conspiracy that the whole Seth Rich narrative is fabricated by, you know, Ed Batowski to benefit.
So he walked it back.
Well, what he does is he shifts focus to what the specific words that are in the retracted story, and he says those specific words are incorrect. And then there was an issue early on. There were two different Fox News stories, as you may recall. There was a local Fox News story that was meant to be a kind of a teaser for the main Fox News story, and the local Fox News story kind of, you know, they got ahead of themselves because it was such a big story, and they made it sound like Wheeler had seen the emails. On that clip that you played, he's very clear he has not seen the emails.
Right.
He's been doing an investigation, and he's saying his investigation. He's commenting on his investigation, which, and he makes very clear that he has not actually seen
any
emails.
His investigation is he has said some other interesting things. Like he met with Detective Della Camera of the Metropolitan Police, who was involved in the Seth investigation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then he sent a message to a Fox reporter, Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells her that he spoke to Seth's father, Joel Rich. And he says that Detective Della Camera didn't show up or arrange the meeting, nor has he returned any of my phone calls, which clearly indicates to me that he's been told not to meet with us, Wheeler wrote to Zimmerman. Additionally, I talked with Joel Rich today via telephone to give him an update. And Joel admitted to me when I first got involved with this investigation and I started calling the police, Joel said, Rod, do you really know the reason why the detective did not call you back when you were calling him? Wheeler says, I said, no, what was the reason? And Joel said, when I called the police department right after that, Donna Brazile, former chairman of the DNC, right, called him and was asking him why I was snooping around asking questions about the death of Seth and his working relationships at the DNC. I was startled to learn that Donna Brazile even knew that I had reached out to the police department. So basically, when I called the police department, that information was immediately given to Donna Brazile. Okay, so Wheeler tries to meet with the police department. Police department calls Donna, and they call Joe to say, hey, why is this guy asking about Seth?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like the DNC and their operatives are trying to control this thing in some way. Is that your view?
Well, I think that there is an attempt to control the narrative. What I'll say about Donna Brazile, and you probably got this from the outstanding discovery requests, is that I requested that we be able to take Donna Brazile's deposition, and I had made that request earlier. I represent two individuals, as you probably know. I represent Ed Batowski, and I represent Matt Couch, and one of the people that, you know, Matt Couch wanted to depose was Donna Brazile. Because there's a statement that was made that Aaron was in a meeting with Donna Brazile and got really angry. This is before the murder.
And a week before, yeah.
A week before, and got in an argument and threw a chair against the wall. Now, I said to the judge, you know, this is my client is being accused for making a defamatory statement. The person best situated to tell us whether that's true or not is Donna Brazile, and I'd like to take her deposition. And the judge denied that, and that is you know that's unfortunate. I think maybe what's going on with the judge is that, you know, that would be an extraordinary fight, you know, because the DNC would not want the, I don't think would want the deposition to go forward, and they do have some, you know, legitimate, you know, First Amendment claims, associational privilege that would protect certain communications. So that would be a knockdown, drag out fight, I think, in terms of what the permissible scope of a deposition would be, and maybe the judge just thinks that would bog things down too much. But
He has a big fight. He comes into her office and has a big fight a week before his brother is murdered, and that's not of any interest. And the other thing is, let me ask you something. Why is Debbie Wasserman not being subpoenaed? She's just disappeared, and she's a key figure, don't you think?
Well, that's a good point, and you know, I think that in the law business, there's a lot of second guessing, and you know, perhaps I should have you know, asked the judge for that deposition as well. But since I was getting, you know, static on Donna Brazile, who seems much more, you know, directly irrelevant, simply because one of the allegations that my client's being sued over, this is Mr. Couch, not Mr. Patowski, is being sued over, you know, directly relates to an incident with her. So, you know, I just thought I was getting so much pushback, you know, I didn't want to try my luck. And also, you know, I was, as you saw, that the document that I submitted was, I think, 30 pages long, and I asked for the ability to take depositions of, you know, Craig Murray, Kim.com, and I felt I was pushing the envelope a little bit in terms of what I was seeking, although everything I was seeking is entirely, you know, reasonable. When I say pushing the envelope, it's simply that I came onto the case late, and, you know, so, you know, I sort of inherited what I inherited. But,
I mean,
that's something. There are other cases pending, as you know. There are several. There's an additional case. I think your listeners probably would want to know. There's an additional case brought by the parents of Seth Rich, also against Mr. Batowski, and they're claiming in that lawsuit that Mr. Batowski, you know, tried, you know, intended to inflict emotional distress on the parents somehow, which is a truly extraordinary allegation. That was thrown out at the trial court level and went up on appeal. And in a remarkable decision that I think is completely wrong, the appellate division, the circuit court, said that no, the parents had stated a proper claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress. Now, that's based on this article that you led this segment with. That deals with Seth Rich, so the parents didn't have any standing to raise any defamation claim, but somehow the court thought that they had properly stated an intentional infliction of emotional distress, which is a claim, which is, you know, truly ludicrous. But anyway, that case is going on, and then Mr. Batowski has fought back, claiming that, you know, he's been defamed by various outlets. You know, CNN and NPR, among them, and so I think your comment about Debbie Wasserman Schultz, while, you know, I'm not going to be able to pursue that in this case, because, I mean, unless I find something that you know, requires me to go back to the judge and say I really must have this deposition, I think that ship has sailed for me. But I think, you know, maybe Mr. Clevenger in one of the other cases could pursue that deposition, because I think you're right. I mean, it's a question it's a fair question.
Well, also the A1, you know, A1, that computer guy who worked for the DNC and all the Democrats who has fled to Pakistan, I think he might be a guy of interest. I just want to go back to Donna Brazile for a second, because one thing I didn't know was that Couch was talking about the possibility that Aaron knew the hit was coming, and that he had told Kelsey Mulka, Seth Rich's girlfriend, to break up with Seth because for her own safety. Mm-hmm. So apparently there's some kind of, you know, implication of foreknowledge that, you know, revenge was coming or something. And a part of the heated discussion may or may not, with Brazile, may or may not have been around that. And what I find so interesting is Donna Brazile's whole demeanor about the Seth Rich thing is kind of bizarre. She keeps, she mentions it. She also put forward these, you know, the Russians did it, not Seth, and this and that. But she still keeps, Seth is obviously on her heart or something. You know, she seems to be haunted by the Seth Rich business. And meanwhile, I'm so struck at how the FBI has behaved. They lied about they lied to Ty Clevenger initially about, you know, about not being having an investigation. And then this Department of Justice, Deborah Sines, could you talk about her? We only have 2 minutes, but could you just talk about her and the duplicity surrounding the whole FBI investigation?
So we only have 2 minutes left. Yeah, you really threw out a lot there. So Deborah Sines was the assistant United States attorney who was responsible for investigating the Seth Rich murder. She's since retired, and Washington, D.C. is a very unique jurisdiction in that the because it's not a state, the local murders are dealt with by federal, U.S. attorneys. So we had the Department of Justice that was involved in this, and I have to confess that I have not reviewed the deposition transcript, but I will say that one of the things that's really fascinating is that that Ms. Sines, and I think she even does this on the Conspiracy Land podcast, admits that there was an investigation into Seth Rich's computer. The claim is that somehow this is what they say somehow at some point after Seth's death the Russians tried to hack into his computer, and so the FBI had to come in and take a look to see if the Russians were hacking in. Now that appears to be not in dispute, so there must be some kind of investigative report. I would think about that investigation.
Well, what's weird about, I read it, and what's weird is, she keeps insisting there, Seth Rich, there's no connection, no Seth Rich connection to this DNC DNC intrusion. You know, he's not involved. She says that 6 ways to Sunday. She says that to Isikoff, who set up Conspiracy Land precisely to address this Seth Rich narrative, okay? And she says it, as she talks to a Rolling Stone reporter. And then, when Clevenger is deposing her, she goes, well, I've been told not to talk about that, so I can't talk about that. I made a mistake talking to Isikoff. I made a mistake, but now I can't talk to you about this. And I'm thinking to myself, this is I'm in Wonderland here, because she got permission by her she got permission to talk about it to Isikoff. That tells me that she has permission to go and promote this narrative,
Right.
And that's not Jesus.
Yeah, that's very look. This is it's very interesting. I mean, I think I would like to see a real investigation by by a team of by a new team, and I think that would be appropriate. And whether it's something that the Barr Durham team could look into, I think it would be appropriate, because there are a lot of unanswered questions.
I am glad that Ty Clevenger finally has filed a complaint against FBI Section Chief David Hardy and with respect to the FOIAs, lying about what the FBI had or didn't have about this case. At least there's some pushback there, because, the FBI's corruption now, it's becoming legendary, It's reached a whole new level or something.
This is one thing let's see if I can pull this up, because I had this that I wanted to... maybe I don't have it. We're out of time. Okay.
Thank you so much. You've got to come back.
Okay, will do. Thank you.